Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Let's talk about the United States Senate, because all of a sudden, very close Senate races just got even more intense, of course, due to the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So today, we're going to focus in particular on the Senate race in Maine and what Susan Collins' fight for re-election says about the U.S. Senate today. But let's start with On Point 2020 political correspondent and WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Hello there, Anthony.
Hi, Meghna. Good to talk to you.
It's great to talk with you. So first of all, give us a lay of the land about how much the death of Justice Ginsburg has had an impact on some of these close races we're seeing for Senate across the country.
Well, I mean, it remains to be seen. I mean, the big question is, could this change mm-hmm. the course of these Senate races and the election in general? And, you know, to understand that, to answer that question, you know, let's talk a moment about where voters were right before Justice Ginsburg's death. And in general, when it comes to the presidential race, Biden is ahead in every battleground state, including Wisconsin, Arizona, Minnesota, also in North Carolina, Nevada, and New Hampshire. So Biden well ahead, on track to get well over 300 electoral votes, according to the latest polling. Now, in the Senate races, you know, the Democrats had advantages in Colorado, in North Carolina, in Iowa, very, very close, but advantages in Montana, Arizona, and Maine. There was just a new poll from the Boston Globe, Suffolk University about Maine, which I know we're going to be talking about a lot. So the big question is, how does this affect it? And, you know, I can look at it in two ways. The New York Times had a fascinating piece today just about how fundraising mm-hmm. Has poured in for Democrats right after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, incredible amounts of money coming in to these Democratic races. So that's encouraging for Democrats. Now, it has to be pointed out that once Donald Trump names a nominee, the same thing could happen on the Republican side. And two other things I just throw out there. I think Donald Trump in general and the Republicans in general are eager to change the subject from the pandemic, mm-hmm. You know, even from the idea of law and order, you know, the idea that Joe Biden is somehow an avatar of chaos, rioting and looting just hasn't stuck. So, you know, Trump and Trump's strongest suit isn't working for him right now in the economy. So all that to say, he'd probably be eager for a chance to change a subject and talk about something else. And the question is, would a fight over the Supreme Court allow him to do that? Would it allow these Senate races to sort of change complexion? And or would it help the Democrats? Yeah. And I can see cases on both sides of that, I guess.
Well, so I wonder, though, I'm just going to I know this is a question that you've already asked, so I'm going to ask it back to you, Anthony. For people whose votes could hinge on the issue of the Supreme Court, aren't they most likely already having – aren't those folks ones who've already made up their minds about who they'd vote for?
I think it's a great point, and I believe that. I mean, I think there's so much we don't know, and I think it's a really interesting question to say, how is this going to affect the election? But I think you're right. I think so many people's attitudes are already locked in place. This is going to be a high turnout election. We know that. And I think the fact that there's going to be a fight about the next Supreme Court nominee is just going to energize the folks who are already energized. I have a hard time imagining that sort of vote in the middle who are still trying to make up their mind are suddenly going to say, oh my gosh, it's the Supreme Court that's going to finally do it for me. You know what I mean? So I don't think that this changes the complexion of the race in a big way, other than sort of galvanizing you know, the forces on the left and on the right who are already galvanized. I mean, mm-hmm. and I'll go back to that New York Times article about, you know, the Democratic activists just raising tons of money in the wake of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. But we're not talking about bringing in new voters there.
Right.
We're talking essentially about more money going after the same collection of voters that were already being targeted.
But to your point about the galvanization on the right and the left of a Supreme Court seat in the balance. I mean, I think the parties on either side would say was it will help in the get out the vote campaign for those voters in the base who may have already made up their minds, but any last little motivation they need to get to the polls, this is it. Anthony, we're going to spend some time throughout this show really focusing on Maine and the interesting story there regarding Susan Collins' bid for re-election. And it's a very close race between her and Sarah Gideon. So first of all, you mentioned there was a poll just recently out. Do you have a little bit more information on where that race stands?
Yeah, this is a fascinating race. So there's a new poll from Suffolk University in the Boston Globe. This was taken right before the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So keep that in mind. Sarah Gideon, the Speaker of the House in Maine, is ahead of Susan Collins, 46 to 41 points. Now, the Globe went back and interviewed some of the respondents about this, and most said they were unimpressed with Collins' announcement that she thinks the Senate should wait until after the election to consider a Supreme Court nominee. And the sense from these voters was they don't trust her, and that's based on the fact that she voted for Brett Kavanaugh. She did not vote to impeach Donald Trump. And, you know, what's interesting about this race is that for decades, Collins successfully presented herself as this Maine moderate. Mm-hmm. And here's some great statistics from 2014. She was able to win the support of almost 40% of Democrats and 72% of those who described themselves as moderates. Now, flash forward to today, and she's struggling with a huge gender gap. She's supported by only 33% of women. Gideon has 54% of women. Gideon's also ahead of Collins with self-described moderates, 52 to 37%. So the polarizing nature of the Trump era has really taken a toll on Collins' reputation as a kind of moderate, someone who could buck the party orthodoxy every now and then. She sort of lost that. Now, one of the questions I have is, you know, now that she said there shouldn't be a vote, she's one of two senators, along with Murkowski of Alaska, to say there shouldn't be a vote on a new nominee until after the election. Does that give her a second chance to sort of say, see, I am that moderate that can buck the party, and will that help her? Or does it come too late, like the Boston Globe suggested by talking to these respondents earlier this week?
Well, let's ask some Mainers that question, Anthony. So hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring into the conversation now Steve Missler. He is chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief at Maine Public Radio, and he joins us from Augusta, Maine. Steve, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure, Magna. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so pick up where Anthony left off. What sense are you getting there amongst Maine voters that this question of the Supreme Court, could it break for or against Senator Collins in her reelection bid?
Well, I think Anthony touched on a couple of things, which is that I think, first of all, this race has already had a pretty firm imprint of judicial appointments made on it by the fact that Senator Collins voted for Brett Kavanaugh in 2018. And then that you can almost draw a straight line from that vote to where she stands now, which is a sharp decline in popularity. I mean, there was a time where she appeared almost indestructible. And then the findings from the poll, but just before that Anthony cited, I think are also important because an illustrative of the struggle that she has, which is she's lost Maine voters, she's lost center left voters, and she's lost Democrats. And these are all part of her big coalition that made her so popular for so many years, nearly 30 years. And so I think as far as what the and what she announced in terms of waiting until the next president is elected to appoint the new judicial nominee. I mean, she also said that President Trump should go ahead and nominate somebody, and that somebody should that they should begin the proceedings, the confirmation process. What she hasn't said is what she'll do is if that vote takes place before the election, and there's a lot of indications that that may happen. And so I think a lot of Mainers are wondering about that, but some of them have probably already made up their minds. I mean, even if she were to vote no before the election on a nominee just out of principle because she didn't think it was fair, I'm not sure how much goodwill that would earn her. I mean, that could be her best path to earning back some of that former coalition. But the problem is that she also has a problem on the right. I think that's one of the reasons why she confirmed Brett Kavanaugh. She was under a lot of pressure from the right to do that. She's already receiving pressure from the right to do it. You heard just yesterday the president say on Fox and Friends, criticize her statement about waiting till the election to pick a new nominee. And he was very critical of that, of her. And I think that that's going to resonate with Trump voters in this state.
So tell me more about that, because what is the electorate of Maine like? Because on the one hand, they have repeatedly sent Susan Collins back to the Senate. On the other hand, voters in Maine twice elected Paul LePage to governor of the state. He was pretty far right. So what is the electorate? What's the mix in the Maine electorate like?
Well, it is pretty perplexing when you think about it. I mean, we often get described as a Democratic state, but that's not really the case. We're really more of a purple state. And that's a lot of that is because of our geography. I mean, a lot of the reason why we often elect a Democratic congressional representatives is because of the first congressional district, which is very, very much Democratic. And then in the second congressional district is much more rural. And in many ways, the state is kind of a microcosm of the country in the sense that we have there's a deep division in many ways. But even in the second district, that has also elected Democrats. And we have a Democratic representative there, Jared Golden, who won in 2018 during the Democratic wave year. And that was a district that President Trump carried by 10 points. So he won it by 10 points. And then prior to that, Obama carried it twice. So it's hard. You almost have to be a center of the road politician to win here.
Well, we're going to ask what center of the road means for Mainers when we come back. So Steve Missler and Anthony Brooks, stand by. We're talking about the close races for the Senate, for several Senate seats across the country, spending some time focusing on Maine, but we'll also touch down on issues going on in other states as well. So we have a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about close races for the United States Senate. I'm joined today by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 political correspondent. Steve Missler is also with us. He's chief political correspondent and State House bureau chief at Maine Public Radio, because we are spending some time in particular, focusing on the Maine Senate race. And now joining us in the conversation is Dan Shea. He is a professor of government at Colby College and author of Why Vote? Essential Questions About the Future of Elections in America. And he joins us from Waterville, Maine. Professor Shea, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, can you just give us a little bit of insight on what Maine's political culture is right now? Because what do you think is making this race so close that Susan Collins can't rely on the power of incumbency like perhaps she used to be able to?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. We've been thinking about that a lot. You know, at its core, has the senator changed or has Maine changed? Mm-hmm. And I do think it's a bit of both. I think there's some evidence to suggest both have changed, but we can stick with the electorate. I think Steve is always smart on these things, and I think he's got it right. But I think what's happened in the state is there is the declining center. I think this is true across the nation. There are fewer swing voters. Mm-hmm. That's been happening for about a decade, I think, since Paul LePage was elected governor in 2010. So, you know, the question is, are there enough moderate voters to support a moderate legislator? I think there's a polarization, a hardening on each side. I think that's particularly true on the right. There's been some sort of internal battles in the Republican ranks. And emerging from that is a more sort of strident LePage slash Trump Republican force in the state. And you're right. I think that the senator has had a tough time keeping them happy, while at the same time appealing to the growing number of independents and Democrats. To be honest, there's been a surge of enrollments of Democrats. Maybe we're purple. I tend to think that we're really shading quite blue lately.
Mm. Well, so, but Professor, let me ask.
If I could,
is that you, Anthony? Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, it's Anthony. I just want to jump in because I think what the professor said is spot on. And I would just sort of even add this. I mean, really what we're seeing here is a shift of the Republican Party nationally. And Collins is caught in the middle of that. I mean, I'm looking at this analysis by 538, Nate Silver's column. And once upon a time, there were 27 senators from 2005, back in 2005, who regularly voted against sort of party orthodoxy. According to Nate Silver, there are now three: Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and Mitt Romney. Those are the only three. So the Republican Party has shifted dramatically under Susan Collins's feet. And, you know, she's got nowhere to go. And she is caught between this sort of Trump shift on the right and then folks on the left and moderates in the middle who want her to do more to stand up to Trump. And the National Republican Party that once embraced people like her and Olympia Snowe and a whole bunch of other people who aren't in the party anymore just isn't there anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, so about the people, the voters who would wish for Senator Collins to stand up more to the president, I just want to play a couple of moments from the two opportunities she had, actually, in this most recent Congress. First of all, here is a moment from her speech in the pivotal role she played in the 2018 confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
The facts presented do not mean that Professor Ford was not sexually assaulted that night or at some other time, but they do lead me to conclude that the allegations failed to meet the more likely than not standard. Therefore, I do not believe that these charges can fairly prevent Judge Kavanaugh from serving on the court.
That was Senator Collins in 2018, and in February of this year, she voted to acquit President Trump in his impeachment trial. Here's what she said.
The House managers described impeachment as a last resort for the Congress. In this case, however, the House chose to skip the basic steps of judicial adjudication and instead leapt straight to impeachment as the first resort. Therefore, I will vote to acquit on Article 2.
Senator Susan Collins in February. So, Professor Shea, I mean, this actually sets us up for what I think is a core question now. When we talk about the declining center, as you put it. I mean, what at all do we mean when we say moderate anymore? Because I think some people would look to Senator Collins and say she has had the opportunity to express her moderation, her political moderation, and yet has actually fallen in line far more regularly with the right wing of the Republican Party than is necessary.
Well, there are particular votes, and there are high profile, you know, events and speeches like that. And there's also sort of an empirical measure, right? We can assess the extent to which she votes with her party mm-hmm. or against her party. About a decade ago, she voted about a third of her time against her Republicans, fellow Republicans in the Senate. In the last year, it was about 10%. So there are high profile events. And I would add on top of that, I think for a lot of Mainers, it's sort of trying to straddle the middle on some of these things, like calling for witnesses, extra witnesses during the impeachment process, the John Bolton thing, but then voting to acquit. On the Ruth Bader Ginsburg issue, saying the Senate shouldn't do this, but not saying that she wouldn't. You know, it's voting to move Betsy DeVos out of committee, but against her on the floor. For a lot of Mainers, that's not moderate, right? That's not in the middle. So I think there are different ways to think about her moderation.
Yeah. So, Steve, jump in here. I mean, how would you answer that same question? I'm seeing here, for example, some voters who are main voters who are disappointed currently with Senator Collins point to her multiple votes against expanding healthcare, for example, or healthcare in particular out of the Senate. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, you only have to go back just 3 years to the time when Senator Collins actually was one of, you know, three Republican senators who helped save the Affordable Care Act from the GOP attempt to, you know, the skinny repeal bill. And she came back to Maine right after that vote and arrived in Bangor Airport to a standing ovation. And that is not the case any longer. And I think Dan is right that the middle, which is where she likes to operate, this middle ground has shrunk. There's not as much room for her to maneuver. And you've seen that, too, in the reaction to both even her impeachment statement, the Supreme Court nomination process statement. And a lot of folks thought that was analogous to what she did with impeachment. There's a lack of trust there now with some folks, particularly on the left and certainly in the middle, that she is, you know, that she before she was almost rewarded for being deliberative. Mm-hmm. And now people find it to be as if she's trying to play both sides, ultimately only to vote for her party at the end. And I think people, some on the left especially, they don't trust that anymore, especially with this president. You know, she's become for a lot of liberals sort of a totem or avatar for congressional Republicans' unwillingness to check the president. And she's, you know, been lampooned on Saturday Night Live and other talk show programs. And I just think that, you know, I think a lot of this is about the president and, you know, that he has shrunk that ground at which she likes to operate. Mm. And I think that, you know, a lot of folks just won't tolerate that now. And I think your question about what is a moderate, I think that maybe another way to phrase the question is she just simply a centrist in the Republican Party, which means that the party moves right and she sort of stays in the middle of a party that has continued to right. move right.
Well, so can I just jump in here, Steve? Because then I don't want to have this conversation, you know, I don't want us to sound as if we're just presuming that this is Susan Collins' race to lose because her party has moved to the right. I mean, how is Sarah Gideon campaigning against Colin? Is she campaigning for those centrist voters, or is she also feeling the pressure of a very restive left? And are there a lot of sort of left-wing voters in Maine?
Well, that's a great question. She's actually campaigning for that middle. She is trying to gather the people that Collins has, you know, if you believe the polls, has lost. She is trying to present herself as a moderate Democrat. And in doing so is trying to handcuff Senator Collins to the president. I mean, even before the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she was trying to draw out Collins in debates and trying to get her to say who she was voting for president this year. She was unsuccessful in doing that. But she has made that a big part of her campaign. And she is more recently trying to chain her to Mitch McConnell. In part because I think, you know, Mitch McConnell is on the ballot as well because of this maneuver to rush forward this nomination process.
Mm. Dan, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think Steve's absolutely right. And she's a good candidate. She's a more moderate. She's got a bit of a record. You know, in Maine, it's a part-time legislature, an amateur legislature with term limits. So even though she's speaker, she was at the beginning of the race not widely known. But all that, it seems to me, is almost beside the point. So I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Colby, my colleagues and I, have been running some polls. We have a new one coming out soon, which, by the way, we asked a question regarding Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that issue. But I will say in the first two rounds of those polls, what we found was the principal predictor of vote choice in the Senate race was attitudes towards Donald Trump. And that is really what is – that is the anvil around the senator's back as she runs for re-election. Can voters vote for Joe Biden and also Susan Collins? I would feel quite strongly that President Trump will not win Maine. But the question then for the senator is, will we see some of these split ticket voters that we've seen in the past? I mean, right? We've mentioned this before. In 2008, Barack Obama won every county in Maine but one. In that same election, Susan Collins won every county. So there were a lot of split ticket voters. The question is, are they still there? Mm.
I don't know why I didn't think of this question earlier, but and I'll throw this out to all three of you. Maine, of all places, is a state where Republicans can switch parties and still win. Right? I mean, like, Angus King is an independent. Why is Susan Collins, if she's found that middle ground being shrunk beneath her feet, why is she staying as – why is she continuing to run as a Republican?
Well, if you don't mind, maybe I'll jump in real fast with a quick anecdote. So we had the senator on campus a few years ago to give a speech, and she did a wonderful job. And, you know, she's speaking to Colby students. So she presented herself rightfully as a moderate. And, you know, she won over the crowd. And there was a question, you know, Senator, you know, why aren't you a Democrat? And she launched into a discussion about her roots in northern Maine, in Caribou and in Bangor. And being Republican in her blood, she is a Republican, and she is a Yankee Republican. But that is who she is through and through.
I would agree with that.
Yankee
that,
Republican. I'll just throw in really quickly. I mean, I'm sort of repeating what I said early, but I love the idea that Dan, you talked about a Yankee Republican, and that brand of Republicanism is just disappearing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Susan Collins just might be one of the last of that brand.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, this was a discussion that was, you know, Senator Collins was actually, you know, contemplating a run for governor. And when she was doing that, she was being trashed by former Governor Paul LePage at the time, you know, basically saying that there was no way that she should run and working behind the scenes. Now, I don't know if that factored into her decision not to run for governor and to remain in the Senate or not. I'm not certain of that. But, the idea is that she, you know, would withdraw from the Republican Party, I don't think it ever crossed her mind. I just think that's who she identifies as. And, you know, the only other option would have been perhaps to retire, which is exactly what Olympia Snowe mm-hmm. did in 2012 when confronted with this Tea Party uprising, that she just found that situation to be untenable. Susan Collins has made a different choice. She's chosen to stay in the Senate and run for reelection. And the question that I keep coming back to is, what if she wins and Donald Trump wins? You know, I think if that were to happen, I wonder what kind of politician Susan Collins will be able to be for the next 6 years. I think the pressure on her will not dissipate just because she won and Donald Trump won. I think it'll be just as high as it is now. And she's going to be under a lot of pressure from Republicans to do what he wants.
Interesting. Well, I want to play one more little bit of tape from Senator Collins. I mean, talking about the shift in her party. This is her in 1996 talking about her stance on abortion during her Senate campaign.
I am pro-choice. Unlike Joe Brennan, I've always been pro-choice and I always will be. But I totally agree with you that there are far too many abortions, that we need to encourage alternatives, we need to encourage more adoption, and we need to make sure that any woman who chooses to have her child has the support that she needs to do that.
That's Susan Collins in 1996. Dan Shea, it seems I don't think I recall Susan Collins being as clear on her stance about abortion in recent years. Could you imagine her saying something like that today?
Well, it would be tougher.
Yeah.
But, you know, Maine is very secular. Mm. And the Republicans in Maine, conservatives in Maine, are different, I think, than in Republicans and conservatives in some other states, maybe some southern states. You know, she's always been a Yankee Republican, fiscally conservative and socially liberal. That's why I think, coming back to this statement about the confirmation vote, my take on that is she had no choice to do that because she would have been really assaulted from the left. From the right, it's not quite as fatal as we might find in some other states.
Mm-hmm. Seems like the other big lesson I'm drawing from you, from all of you, is the nationalization of races at the state level as well. So Dan Shea, professor of government at Colby College and author of Why Vote, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Steve Missler, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. Steve, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Anthony, stick with us, because when we come back, we'll talk about some other key races, Senate races around the country. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are taking a look at Senate races in key states across the country, places where the races are very close, and asking how recent news, including the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, might have an impact on those races. I'm joined today by Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 political correspondent and also senior political reporter at WBUR. And Anthony, we were focusing a lot on Maine because of the interesting long Senate career of Senator Susan Collins there, who's running for re-election, and in the fight of her life, actually, I would say, in her many years and multiple re-election runs, this one is the toughest she's probably faced. But we're seeing something similar elsewhere. I mean, there are, Arizona, North Carolina, Colorado. There's a lot of states where it's quite close.
Yeah, I mean, we can lay the groundwork this way. I mean, Democrats need to pick up 4 seats to guarantee a Senate majority, or 3 seats if they win the White House, in which case the vice president would cast the deciding vote. So as you said, Colorado, North Carolina, Iowa, Montana, Arizona, and Maine, as we've been discussing, those are the 5 likeliest states that Democrats are focused on. There are others, but those are the ones that are all leaning in a Democratic direction. Iowa is extremely close. That's where Teresa Greenfield is challenging Senator Joni Ernst. North Carolina is close, too, but Cal Cunningham has a lead over Senator Tom Tillis. John Hickenlooper in Colorado has a big lead over Cory Gardner. That's a likely Democratic pickup. And Mark Kelly has been leading Senator Martha McSally in Arizona consistently. So at this point, it looks fairly good for Democrats, but
the question at the heart of this program is, does the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg change these races in any appreciable way, either in the Democrats' advantage or the Republican advantage? Mm-hmm. And that's a harder question to answer.
Well, let's turn now to Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. She joins us from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So it seems as if the news simply does not stop on this front. Anthony just rightly reminded us about how the Supreme Court might affect the Senate races and the presidential race. If we can, just for a moment, should we talk about Mitt Romney, Sungmin?
We should. That's where I was actually rushing from to talk with you this morning. Senator Romney just talked with a couple of reporters here on Capitol Hill and laid out his reasoning for why he supports a vote this year, even though we are just weeks out from an election. And we pressed him on this, and he said, look, this is he believes it's the right decision. He believes it goes with historical precedent, and he does not seem to be uncomfortable with the fact that we are, you know, just 42 days or so out from an election where there could conceivably be a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate chosen. And Romney's decision is really significant here because that means Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has enough votes to at least proceed with the process. We know there were, you know, Susan Collins, like we discussed earlier, and Lisa Murkowski were very uncomfortable with voting before November 3rd. They did not support that proceeding, but there is a majority of senators to at least go with the process here and hold a vote this year.
So that's it seems as if a major victory then for Mitch McConnell. And there, he's given every indication that he will press forward as vigorously as he can.
Right. I mean, if there's one thing that you need to know about Mitch McConnell is that the courts are his passion. That is a project that is decades in the making for him. And for him to be majority leader when the Supreme Court, if, you know, President Trump's nominee is successfully confirmed, to be majority leader when the Supreme Court cements a 6-3 conservative majority for years, maybe even a generation to come, will be a monumental victory for McConnell personally.
Okay. Anthony, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested to hear the news about Mitt Romney. And it makes me think of this point that Romney, of course, wasn't a senator during the 2016 Supreme Court debate when the Senate refused to take up President Obama's selection of Merrick Garland. But at least three Republican senators, I think if I'm counting them right, who are facing Democratic challenges have all said they would support voting for a new Supreme Court nominee before the next election, even though they took the position back in 2016 that the Senate should not consider Barack Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland. So back then, Lindsey Graham, Joni Ernst, and Martha McSally all said words to the effect that voting is already underway, as it is today, by the way, and that Americans should be allowed to vote first before a Supreme Court nominee is considered. Graham even said, and I'll quote him, "I want you to use my words against me. If there's a Republican president in 2016 and a vacancy occurs in the last year of the first term, you can say, Lindsey Graham said, let's let the next president, whoever it might be, make the nomination." Mm-hmm. So that's what Graham said back in 2016. He's saying something very different today. And I guess I'm just sort of stunned by, I mean, there's no other word than to call that hypocrisy. But the question is, does it matter to voters? And maybe not, because we are so polarized. And this is just seen as, this is the way politics is right now. You know, you when you've got the advantage, you take it and you run. You take the ball and you run with it.
Now, Sungmin Kim, just help us keep all our ducks in a row here. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, is he seeking to bring a vote, a floor vote about on a nominee before the election?
He hasn't. So for McConnell's part, he has not specifically laid out a timing.
Okay.
If you looked at his statement right after Justice Ginsburg's death on Friday night, he says the nominee will get a vote in the Senate, but he does not say before or after the election. And knowing McConnell, I would surmise that he was doing that because he needed to line up that majority of votes just to proceed with the nomination, which he did today. So that was McConnell, you know, kind of being careful, making sure all his ducks were in a row. But I would not be surprised if we heard some sort of an announcement from Mitch McConnell later this afternoon that perhaps there will be a vote this year before November 3rd. Lindsey Graham actually pretty much said that on Fox News yesterday in an interview last night. He is the Judiciary Committee chairman. He will be in charge of these hearings. And he said, we can proceed now. I don't know if you talked to Mitt Romney before us reporters did this morning, but they will proceed this year before the election.
Mm. Now, we're having this conversation in the context of the Senate itself and what impact this open court seat is having on key Senate races. What have you heard on the Hill about, is there a concern about how this might be handled and what impact that might have on Republicans who are in these close races?
Well, I think it's really interesting to step back and kind of look at the 2016 parallels when Republicans held up Merrick Garland. You know, I'm not weighing in on the merits of whether it was right, what Republicans are doing then or Republicans doing now. But people working on this races tell me that and you saw this in 2016, too, that process argument doesn't actually resonate all that much with voters because, as we discussed earlier, we are in this very, Democratic Jersey, Republican Jersey environment where it is very polarized. You are most people are part of their team, and there aren't a lot of defections on a lot of these issues. So the process argument, while we can point out that Republican senators are taking a different position than they did in 2016, it may not resonate with voters as much as the fact that for Republicans, it's a chance to get a conservative Supreme Court. For mm-hmm. Democrats, this is a concern about them. You know, having a Supreme Court that may alter what we're seeing in terms of access to abortion, the future of the Affordable Care Act, voting rights, civil rights. Those are the messages that resonate more for voters, which is what people on both sides are telling me. I think there's a broader view right now that the Supreme Court fight probably hurts Cory Gardner in Colorado and most certainly Susan Collins mm-hmm. in Maine. But writ large, even though this is a difficult environment for Republicans, like we've seen for much of the year, a lot of the states where the Senate majority will be won will be in states that are still, you know, purple, but with like a red leading tint. You talk about North Carolina and Iowa, for example. And, you know, Republicans tell me that this is something that could really galvanize base voters in those states and get them excited and get them to come out and support that the Republican candidate for Senate.
So can we just talk for a second about South Carolina, though? Because obviously Senator Graham at the center of the Supreme Court issue as chairman of Judiciary, I think he was on Fox just yesterday talking about the millions of dollars that Democrats raised in 48 hours over the weekend. And he is in a very, if I'm reading the polls right here, he's in a very tight race with Democrat Jamie Harrison there, right? Aren't they pretty much tied, Anthony? Is that what you're seeing?
According to the latest Quinnipiac poll, it shows the race tied, tied essentially. Mm. And the other thing that's interesting is Jamie Harrison had a record-breaking week before Justice Ginsburg died, raising something like $2 million in the 2 days after that poll showed the race tied. So this gets back to that thing we were talking about, that issue we were talking about at the start of the program, just in terms of who this is helping. At least initially, the money has just been pouring into the Senate side of these the Democratic side of these Senate races. I'd be curious to know, is the same thing going to happen for the Republicans mm-hmm. Once this debate starts in earnest on Capitol Hill over the next hearing for the next Supreme Court justice? It's really interesting to know. But it is stunning to me to see Lindsey Graham in a tied race in South Carolina. I'm not convinced that sticks all the way until Election Day, but it's quite stunning today.
Sungmin Kim, did you want to just chime in at all about how this might be having an impact on Senator Graham?
It is a fascinating fascinating a race to watch. And yes, that Quinnipiac poll was certainly surprising. Republicans, including Lindsey Graham himself, kind of tried to, you know, unskew the poll a little bit and told his reporters on Capitol Hill that, for example, that poll undersampled Republican voters. So they're not convinced that poll is accurate, but Republicans are certainly watching that race in South Carolina. South Carolina should not be a swing state for Republicans in a Senate race. So definitely there's some concern, not necessarily that Lindsey Graham will lose that race. Republicans are still confident that that he will keep his seat, but that, for example, they might have to expend resources to help kind of save Lindsey Graham, considering Jamie Harrison is so well financed and is just raking in money. So that is one concern that Republicans have to be watch out for. And also, you know, politics is a lot about momentum and narrative. And if the narrative and the sense kind of sticks and holds that Republicans are struggling, even in ruby red South Carolina, that is certainly something that is not going to be helpful to Republicans. But definitely this is going to have the Supreme Court fight is going to have a definite galvanizing effect on Senator Graham. And, you know, Lindsey Graham took a pretty center stage role in the Kavanaugh fight, and he wasn't even the chairman then. I mean, I think we all remember his angry remarks towards Democrats a couple of years ago in the Kavanaugh hearings. And I think now that he controls the gavel, he wields that gavel, you're going to see him in a much central role this time around.
Right. Well, and one more question for you. How is all of this, the question about what might happen in the Senate, how is that playing at the White House? Is it a concern of the president's at all?
Well, the president is focused on winning his reelection in November and making sure that his Supreme Court nominee comes through. I think there are, according to our reporting, there are some competing thoughts here, because we've seen just the Democratic anger and also enthusiasm for the prospect of losing that Ginsburg seat. You saw the record donations to Democratic candidates. You've seen the growing grassroots pressure on Democratic senators to fight this nomination as hard as they can. The courts have generally been a galvanizing issue for Republican voters in the past decade, but there is recent polling from Pew and other places that courts are actually starting to matter more to Democrats, which is a fascinating voter shift in the last couple of years. So I think President Trump's advisors are clearly watching that. They acknowledge the potential for this to galvanize their base voters and their electorate, which is why they're considering Judge Amy Coney Barrett, who is a nominee who will certainly get their base, particularly with evangelical voters and Catholic voters, very excited. But they're all also watching kind of the potential blowback. One of the people close to the president told us last night that they don't necessarily want to make this a race about abortion, because that will completely galvanize the left, and that they may face a backlash of polls in November.
Interesting. Well, Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anthony, we got about a minute and a half left here, and you've covered multiple elections, many election cycles. Just your last thought for how all these things are coming together in a big national picture, which seems so uncertain right now.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Sungmin Kim put a really good sort of final point there, that it's really an open question. I mean, I think when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, my first thought was, of course, this is going to help Republicans, because it's going to allow Donald Trump to change the subject and move away from the pandemic and remind his supporters of some of the things he's accomplished, which has included, putting a whole lot of conservative judges on the judiciary, including in the Supreme Court. So that seems to help him. But as was stated really clearly, this could also backfire and galvanize Democrats who are concerned about abortion rights. And by the way, the Affordable Care Act, I mean, let's not forget about that. That led to a blue wave in 2018 concerned about losing health care. So it could go either way. Fascinating moment.
Yeah. And of course, the ACA is in a case that's before the Supreme Court. So
that's right.
Anthony Brooks on Points 2020, political correspondent. It's always great to talk with you, Anthony. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Meghna. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.